Uh-oh. My name's Ed Perry, and I'm an alcoholic. There's two very, very true things. The rest, I'll give it a shot. So I haven't done this for quite some time. My sobriety date is February 20th, 1985. Thank you, Lord. I get emotional when I talk about that. Because I came to In and Out every 7 years since I was 25 years old. Not on a regular basis. My first wife told me I came here about every 5 to 7 years, and I would stay anywhere from one meeting to 3 weeks, and I'd hit the skids again. And that's something. I don't remember some of them. Not because I was stewed to the eyeballs, I just don't remember some of them. I come from a family sprinkled with alkies, like a lot of us, I think. I was born in Washington, Pennsylvania, about 35 miles outside of Pittsburgh. And there was six of us, and we moved to Pittsburgh all of a sudden when I was 6 years old. I was second to the youngest. And didn't know till later it was because my mother and dad split up. She found him in bed with her sister. Ladies do not like that. Just pisses them off. So he was out. And we moved into the city of Pittsburgh, and that's where I was raised till I went into the service when I was 18. It was an average blue-collar working type neighborhood, a lot of good people, a lot of good friends that I had. And there was about three families in the whole neighborhood, four or five streets, and I knew everybody. We got to know everybody, they got to know us. And there was about three families that were considered poor, and we were one of them. A couple of times the church brought boxes of food up, and my mother would cry, and I'd be thinking, let's go, who got here? Let's see what's in that box. So, one thing I can remember a lot of alkies talk about, and that's being afraid. I really like that, Scott. I didn't know I was afraid. Kids growing up, they have, well, we did anyway. Well, incidentally, I'm not going to say much about drugs because I came before that. I'm old, you know. 1955, I was 17 years old. First time I heard about drugs was 1954, I was 11th grade. The Suits came into school and they took two guys out who were seniors and one girl. I didn't like the guys anyway, but the girl was the prettiest gal in senior class. And the whisper around the school was they were in a dope ring. And we didn't know what a dope ring was, but they were in one. First time I ever heard anything about drugs. My brother was a machine gunner in the 1st Regiment in Korea. And when he came home from Korea, he walked the other brother, who's a year older than me and myself, down to a tavern. We all bought beer. He bought us beer. And back then, in where I come from, you could reach the bar and you had somebody older with you, they'd give you a beer. And so we had some beer and we went home. I think he marched us home because he was still in the service. And sometime later when he was on a weekend, he took me down there and I had three shots and three beers, I think. And by the time we got home, my stomach was going upside down and backwards. I threw up everything I'd probably eaten in the last day and a half and slept into the next day and I was ready. On weekends, I would put my fancy rainbow jacket on and my crease slacks, and he taught us how to shine our shoes, and I'd go down and hang around the Texaco station, because those Korean veterans would sometimes say, come on, kid, go with us, and they'd go up to the Globe and do some drinking. So I just was so glad to go with them. Was I an alky then? I don't know. Went into the service at 18, because my brother was a jarhead, and I wanted to be like him. And from what I heard about boot camp, I didn't think I'd make it through. And I made it through Paris Island, South Carolina. We referred to it as Land God Forgot. And spent 3 years at Hitch in the Marine Corps. Great place for drinking. Military is a great place for drinking. Can only do it every 2 weeks, that's when I got paid. And sometimes I would be smart and get my cigarettes and other stuff I'd need before I'd go drinking, because after that there was nothing left. And when I wasn't smart and went drinking and didn't get that stuff, I was the guy borrowing 10 bucks and paying back 20. Because I wanted a little drinky poo. And it never came to me that I had to drink. It didn't come to decades. I wanted to drink. So, and like Scott shared, I loved drinking. Came to California in 1961, deserted my family for the first time. My first wife, her sister became ill with tuberculosis, lived in Georgia. My wife went down there to take care of the children while she went to Valley Forge, Pennsylvania, the tuberculosis hospital, which she did. And then after she got better, she came back home to Georgia, and my wife came back home to Pittsburgh, and I wasn't there. I had applied for a mobile credit card, and I didn't. I think I made $375 a month, and that was bad money back then. And they sent me one. I packed up a loaf of bread, a package of bologna, mayonnaise, my clothes, and deserted. Went to California. My wife got home to her husband waiting for some good loving, and I wasn't there. I was gone. She called California to talk to my mom, see where I was, and I answered the phone. And then she came out to California, and that's a... I don't know which part of my story it is, but I was a runaway. I just ran away over and over. And, I would get to drinking and make a decision. I'm going to San Francisco, lived in Santa Monica, and I'd come out of a blackout somewhere up north of Malibu and turn around and hitchhike all the way back home. And I did that one time, and before I even left Pittsburgh, I did that once. Going to go to Maine to see a friend of mine who I was in service with. I got as far as Somerset, Pennsylvania, 90 miles from Pittsburgh. And I said, where are we going? And the bus driver said, told me where we're going. I said, where are we? He said, we're in Somerset, Pennsylvania. Can I get out? And he said, sure, and pulled over and let me out. And I walked down the road a little ways, and there was a place called the Willows. And I went in there and had a glass of iced tea and walked across the road and hitchhiked all the way back to Pittsburgh. Runaway. Just didn't know why. I just had to escape, I guess. Anyway, I got a good job in California. I was a bakery driver for what I still think is the best bakery in Southern California, maybe in the West. The reason I say that is because after being there for 12 years, I quit the best job I had, working for the best bakery there ever was, serving the best chain of drive-thrus that there ever was. And the reason I quit is because my boss accused me of something that I did. And I never liked that. So I went over and circled the calendar and said, I'm about ready to let you guys carry this, because I thought, sure, they'd collapse without me. And he had the nerve to say, sure. So I quit that job. Every time I did that, things went lower for some reason. And then after about 3 or 4 weeks, my family started saying things like, you know, we're hungry, we'd like to eat. And so I went and got a job with another bakery on vacation routes, and that's where I learned what a bread man was, because at that first bakery I worked, they called me the banker. I had a truck with a big lift gate, served stacks of boxes and stacks of boxes, Top Gun and all that good stuff that we can get to, and then gave it away, of course. And I had like 12 stops at that bakery, and I had 52 stops on the first route. They put me on at this other place. You want 3 loaves of white bread? I was used to serving 120 dozen of hamburger buns. So I started that stuff. Did that until, I guess it was till my brother went into the roofing business. He was a baker driver. he bought a roofing company. And I thought, what in the world? You don't know anything about roof. What are you doing? And so he bought this roofing company, and we'd go drinking now and again, and he'd say, you know, why don't you come into the roofing business? You'll throw stones at that bread business. So without, I didn't know we were supposed to do that, without consulting my wife, without consulting anybody, I just quit the bakery business and went into roofing with him. And he had me sitting and reading specs and all this stuff about how you do this, and he had me working the kettle and doing all that stuff for the first couple months. And I was in the roofing business. So I stayed in that. I've got to make this straight because I don't want people to think I'm one of them roofers. We had roofing mechanics. I did the estimating, the troubleshooting, clean hands. I did that part. And I got pretty good at that. I got pretty good at getting customers. And I went in with him in 77. He bought it in 75. I went in with 77. And by 1980, we had almost quadrupled the business. So we were doing real good. And then he got burnt out and wanted out of it. And I asked him, okay, you think I buy you out? And he said, I don't think you have enough to buy me out. You shouldn't say that to an Alky. So I went home, took a second out of my home, and bought him out. And you know how Bill Wilson talks about, I had arrived at that one point in his life when everything was really rolling? That's the way I felt when I bought him out. I sat in that big leather chair, and I thought I'd arrived. And the first thing I did was went on a two-hour lunch with my secretary and another gal. And that's what I thought I should do. 4 years later, I bankrupted the company. And it was a good company. So that's happened over and over in my life. When I hear some folks tell their stories, guys and gals, of the places they've been and the things I've done, I thought, Jesus, I just drank and went to the bathroom. But you know, I was a barroom drunk, and if you're a barroom drunk, occasionally something will happen. Not necessarily you'll get in a fight or something, but not nice things will happen, like the crash of 67. I was driving a 66 Volkswagen and ran into a 63 Chevy Bel Air. Don't do that in a Volkswagen. Came to in UCLA, and they repaired the bottom of my face. And then that was before I quit the bakery. When I quit the bakery, within a year and a half, I had two DUIs. And I like this because, you know the 20 questions you fill out? And I really tried when I first filled those out. And I did only get only 12 yeses. And my sponsor looked at them. I had two sponsors. I had a guy taking me through the big book. His name was David Farrar. Hell of a guy, very factual, just taking me through the book once I was struck sober. And then Crazy Jerry came back in my life at about 3 weeks sober. He was a wild New Yorker, and he was my lifesaver. He had worked for my brother and I one time. Came back in my life, and he was my lifesaver. Anyway, when David was taking me through the book, we were reading that part about... I'm getting a little ahead of myself, because I came to AA and I didn't understand. Let me get into the last time I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. July 1st, 1984. Somebody got sober. Somebody went into a 28-day program and got sober. My daughter, AJ. And so we had to go to these family nights, they called them. Little round table. I called them good cop and bad cop. These two guys would talk to people and ask you what you do and what's your part in the family. And I thought it was kind of interesting. And I really thought they were going to find out it's my wife's fault that I drank. You know? They never told me that. And so I decided, well, they're too kind. What are they going to say? Can't be rude to her. And I really thought like that. So every Wednesday and Friday, they had them A&A meetings downstairs. So I started going to those meetings. Now, this is, I say, my daughter can straighten me out, because sometimes I remember things, and I'm told later on, that's not the way it happened at all. But to me, the way it was had those AA meetings downstairs Wednesday and Friday, big meetings. And they'd say, any new friends? And it seemed to me that my wife was going like this, looking at me, and my daughter was going like this, looking at me. And after about the fourth time, I just raised my hand, and in here where I live, I said, this doesn't work for an alcoholic of my type. And incidentally, a man named Ralph straightened me out on that once I was struck sober and said something to that effect. Oh, I was trying to get sober going to meetings. And I told him about alcoholic of my type. And he straightened me out. He said, you're the alcoholic of the type who still wants to drink. And that's what it was. Every form of experimentation and denial and everything else I could do. They asked me such things when I was going to a lot of meetings after that July 1st. 13 meetings a week, getting drunk every 30 or 60 days. And finally, I just decided I'll show improvement. And that's better than I was doing. And so the people would get up and say things and talk about the steps. And some guy said, we just want to put it in your head. You need to do all that stuff. And I said, you're talking about the step. Take this. What the Sam hell? You take them. Well, you take them off the wall. What the hell are you talking about? I just couldn't get it. What's the matter with it? I just couldn't get it. And I was too proud to go tell people. I couldn't get it. Anyway, decided I wasn't going to go to AA anymore. That's enough of that shit. I don't have what these people have. I got something that these people don't have, and that's why I shouldn't go there. Or I don't have something that these people all have, and that's why I shouldn't go there. Which means I can still drink, you know. Subconsciously, that means I can drink. So I wasn't going to go to AA anymore, and somebody squealed on me. Told the guys I hung around with, my dad's not going to meetings anymore. I might get a little emotional over this part because it gets me. A little fat guy named Keith Kay came up to my house, heard I wasn't going to meetings anymore. He knocked on the door and they made the mistake of letting him in. And he started giving me that. He 12 stepped me, but he did. He started giving me, you don't owe those people nothing. They don't know you drank. The hell with those people. You put your hand behind that chair, you own that place. Everybody, where we got sober, everybody knows when you drink. So anyway, that was a little sicky poo, and he kept talking. Finally, I got kind of, all right, I'll go to the damn meeting with you. That was a Saturday night participation speaker meeting at Commercial OA in Woodland Hills. So we went to that meeting, and he told me, they don't need to know nothing about you, so first thing they'd do is, any newcomers? And Keith raised over and raised my hand. And boy, I could feel the red going up my neck and all that crap. And the lady led that meeting. I don't know her to this day. Didn't know her at the time. Never met her after that because there's 100 people in that meeting. And she said, I want to hear from this guy over here. And I was sitting in my usual position, clapping for whoever's going up. And Keith elbowed me and said, she wants to hear from you, butthead. I cleaned that up a little bit. I went up there and thought, oh, crap, and sniveling and whining and all that stuff. And, you know, I want to make it, and I can. I don't want to lose what I'm missing. And I got all done, and different ones come up and said different things, actually talking like right to me. Well, Jim F. came up there and said, you know, you're probably sitting there feeling guilty. That's because you are. And somebody else would get up and talk about something. Or you say you're missing the boat and all this. And I still remember the main speaker that night was a girl named Aileen. Don't remember her last name. She and her hubby moved out to the high desert. They had gotten sober in the valley. She was our speaker. And she said, before I give my talk, I want to say something to Ed. She said, honey, you said you're missing the boat. You're in the boat. Grab an oar and row like hell. Everybody just laughed, and I was still like, what the sin? Oh, grab an oar. What are you, nuts? I just couldn't get through. Anyway, all during her pitch, I just felt like I was flowing up inside. And when she was all done, and of course, we got her on, 100 people got her on, held hands like sissies and said the Lord's Prayer. And I ran out of that place and jumped in my truck, driving up Owens, and I was going to my house. Bam. Like a sparkling rain shower fell all over me. And I started yelling, I'm the disease. I've known it for since. Haven't had a drink since. And the next day I was able to do something I wasn't able to do up to that time. I was able to call again, ask him if he helped me stay sober. And of course, he said, "This again, eh, butthead?" "Yeah, read the preface. Call me back after you read it." He said, "And how'd it go?" And I thought, "Well, that's weird. What do you want?" So I did that, and I called him back, and he said, "Well, you're second fastest so far." I know today he just wanted to find out if I was willing. I've done that with quite a few guys over the years. Probably 3 or 4 called me back. We alcoholics don't give up till we're dead 6 months. We just don't. So, and I was struck sober, and the next day, everything was different. I went to a Sunday meeting, and there was some folks, you know, "Hi, Ed, when's your sobriety date? Ha, ha, ha." It meant nothing to me from then on when they said that. I understood. Of course I'm going to think that way. It was 6 different times I got drunk in that 7.5 months. So I started doing that, and David met with me. He had a job. I was busy losing the company. And he would be, I went to a meeting. I lived in meetings, by the way. Lived in meetings. Every night, 3 or 4 on the weekends. Nooners when I could. And he'd get together and he started taking me through the big book. And he started explaining things to me. Well, number one, in the preface to one of the forwards where it talks about the growth of AA, he explained to me, you know, he said, "This isn't a splash in a pan. This started with 2 guys. And second edition was 150,000 people. Third edition was over 1 million. He said, "This ain't a splash in the pan." Just trying to get me to understand. I'm selfish and narrow-minded about things. And then we got a little farther in the book because before I got sober, these guys would come up and talk to me. "Well, you drank every day, didn't you?" "I did not." "You drank in the morning?" "I did not." 6 a.m., you guys are drinking. "I've got 4 stops already taken care of." And of course, they said, "What did you do after work?" "Well, a few drinks, a couple of laughs after work." So David showed me in the big book, reading through there, and he said, "There's this part right here. You knew enough about me by that time." And he said, "He may or may not become a continuous hard drinker." And I thought, well, maybe. Then we got to that part where a change of environment, falling in love, change of job, moving, things like that. And he would add, 2 DUIs, crash on the freeway, leaving your wife. And I go, shit. So he helped me understand better and better. And today when I think about it, it's really kind of weird because I'm on every page of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was then. I just wasn't buying. See, you folks wanted me not to drink on Friday, and everybody drinks on Friday. So, a lot of things have happened. Scott was talking about the success, and I love to hear about success. I've had that, and I've also had some failures. And I had trouble in the roofing business with a particular job. My guys were supposed to do something. I was away. They didn't do it. And the lady called me up and said, "She's ruined. Her place is ruined, all that stuff, commercial building." And I thought, "I'm done. I'm out of business. I'm ruined." Went there, and cost me the half the price of the job and a lot of thousands of dollars after that, but I made that job correct because I just felt like that's what I should do. And I gave the old, won't hear from them again. 3 years later, they called me and had another job for me to do. And the guy said, "Well, one thing I know about you, you'll take care of business." That happened to me 2 different times. And I bankrupted that company at the end of 85. And had to start over. Called some friends I knew, got back in the bakery business. Did that for a while, did different things for a while. And then started back up in the roof. I just had some good times and I had some bad times. The bad times were caused by me in the roofing business, the bad times were caused by me after that. When I didn't do things. Let's put it this way. When I first got into the roofing business on my own, somebody came in and paid me $6,000 cash. "You take this?" I thought it was mine. You're supposed to pay the supplier, you're supposed to pay the men, was by your taxes, what's left, if there's any, that's mine. So, did that a couple of times and tried to correct that, and it was a little late. So, at one time, I went to work for a drive-in restaurant. I knew the guys there, and they put me to work. Me and the rest of the little guys, 18 years old, were working there. And people liked me when I went to work. I wasn't there any time at all. They were training me to be one of the cooks. And the boss man came out and gave me the psychological and all this different kind of tests and stuff. And I knew what he had in mind. He had me in mind. He wanted to make me partner to get me up into the ranks. But I really didn't like staying in one place and dealing with that many people every day. So I stopped doing that, ended up back in the bakery business. I ended up going into the bakery business, back into roofing, back in the bakery business, back into roofing. And this thing called God, not me, ended up, I had 20 years in the bakery business and got a 20-year retirement. I didn't even know it until I called up to put in my union card. And they told me, you could retire if you want to. And so I did. I got a little retirement from that. What else have I done?
Got married.
Why'd you think of that? I had, one of the things I did when I was six, I was a little over 6 years and I left a 33-year marriage. And for lack of a better way to put it, and I've talked to other guys and other guys have helped me, and the only thing we ever come up with is I just didn't want either anymore. And I felt terrible about that for her, still do when I think about it, because I think it killed her heart, or almost did. But I never felt sorry for myself about it. A little interjection here. The Allen family group put her back together. And at her memorial, passed away a couple of years ago, I was allowed to be there. And these gals got up and shared about her and what all she had done for them. And I thought, damn, they just not only put her back together, she helped other people after that. So it was really good. The marriage. I had been away from her for 5 years. Going to play the field, you know, miss her. Then I'm at this chicken barbecue, a gal. I moved up to Ojai, California. One of those coincidences. My buddy moved up there. Old Arnold was from my men's stag. He moved up there and he called me and said, get up here, this lady wants to sell her house. I said, Arnold, I'd just gone through a divorce, or not a divorce, but a separation. Didn't have any. I said, I don't have any money. She don't want any money, get up here. And I went up and talked to this gal, told her what I had coming in, told her all I could pay. Okay, and she moved out of that joint, went back to Oklahoma, and trusted me to be there and start making payments. And left all the furniture. I think she took the stereo or something. Left all the furniture. Moved into a furnished mobile home in Ojai. So I'm up in Ojai, and in 96 I go to this party I was invited to, this girl's boyfriend's birthday. And I look across and there's this gal in shorts. And I like girls in shorts, you know. And I said, whoa, who's that? She's with this white-haired guy. I thought, well, she's taken. So anyway, go to a couple more meetings, and this gal's going to meetings. And so I talked to a friend of mine who knows her better than I did. He said, no. He said, they're just friends. That's nothing. She's available. So I don't know if she asked me or if I asked her, but one Friday night we went to...
You asked me.
One Friday night we went to Caro's. And we split a chocolate milkshake. That was our first date. That was a little different than going to the chestnut room, get about half loop, and look at how are you doing, you know. So Peggy and I started dating. We married and had an AA wedding, September of 1999. About 100 people thereabouts. the one men's meeting, one men's breakfast meeting, they did all the cooking, the chicken, the burgers, all that. And somebody else took charge of the baking. And our friend David from the floral shop did all the flowers for the gals and all that stuff. And it was a beautiful thing. And so we started our life together. And come September, if she don't kick me out, it'll be 25 years. That's better than a poke in the eye. I told her, my first one lasted 33 years. So I told her after 33 years, we both have to renegotiate. Well, I'm 86 years old. I don't know what the odds are for that one. I've had joyous times in AA where I just felt nothing could ever get better than this. And I've had other times when I was scared to death and couldn't see a blank page for the next day and thought, I'm done, I'm washed up. And you want to hear the best news of all, and I hope it always is like that. Not once did I think of a drink since I was struck sober. Not once. It was out. Didn't even think about it. I'm an alcoholic. When I think about it, I'm gone. When I drank, I'm the guy that had, when my two babies, my son was maybe 6 or 7, my daughter was 2 or 3, had my wife, I was still a bakery driver, had my wife take me to work in our little 63 Chevy 2. She got dressed, got the kids ready, took me to work at 4 a.m., so I'd be sure that I'd go home that day after work. And somewhere along the day, it would happen. I'd start thinking about drinking. I would forget all about the fact that my wife has the kids. I'd pull in the driveway to the bakery. What the Sam hell is she doing here? I'm the one who told her to be there. I'd go into the bakery, check in, sneak out the back door, lay in my buddy's car in the front seat, and go drinking. And he was sitting there. I didn't want to do that. I had to do that. That's when booze called me, get out of my way. I'm going to drink. If you and I are talking, standing there, and you're my best friend, you say it, if you walk in that bar, we're done. The lifetime is, the friendship is over. I understand it, and I'd shake your hand. You go do what you have to do, and I have to do what I have to do. Because when I wanted to drink, get out of the way. So I used to have a terminally unique saying. When I don't want to drink, Jesus Christ can't make me. When I want to drink, Jesus Christ can't stop me. I was only half right on that one. I don't mention the thing called God very often, but it's what governs my life. Just being around this long and growing, taking the steps, talking to somebody else about crap that goes on, doing all the stuff we do. I was IGR many times, I was GSR a couple of times, did not finish the second tour of GSR because they didn't really want to do it. Nobody else would volunteer, so I did. And I didn't last 2 years on that one. Did all that stuff. And because of all that, I'm still here. I stay close. I'm 39 years sober, thank you, God. I go to 4 meetings a week. Peggy and I live in Moccasin, Utah, Moccasin, Arizona. We didn't want to come there. Bad things happened. And between 2018 and 2020, money got invested in a sure thing, we would be millionaires, and we were scammed out of everything we had. And not only us, but Peggy's daughter lost 7 times what we lost. So, blank page, had to sell everything. Talked to my sister, she lives in St. George, Utah. I got this home, she said, it's not very much out in Moccasin, Arizona. You're welcome to come there and stay as you want. You better come up and look at it first. I came up and looked, it's 3-bedroom, 2-bath, nice home. Weeds, everything in Arizona is weeds. I don't understand that, I still don't get that. I go from our place in, you know, the Arizona Strait, they call it, whatever they call that, heading for St. George, Utah. Beautiful homes. All around them, weeds. What the Sam hell? Where's your green grass? Get a road scraper and get that shit out of there. I tell that to my friends at the meeting, they don't even pay attention to us. That's what they do. they live in the weeds. So I knocked all the weeds down on our half acre anyway. Now we just have goat heads and a pain in the ass. So we lost everything. We had to sell everything, and that's how we ended up in Moccasin, Arizona. One of my friends in Ojai, California, said, Eddie, I called up about what's going to cost to get our stuff up. It was over $1,000 to have our stuff brought up here. Eddie, he said, I've got a horse trailer, he said. It's really clean. We keep it really clean. He said, my wife and I want to go on a vacation. I'd like to tow all your stuff there, stuff up there for you. And he did that. This guy in AA put me to shame for generosity and selflessness. Incidentally, when I read that in the big book, it's in the big book. This can't be done without self-sacrifice and unselfish constructive action. And when I read that, I said, I'll never make it here. I forgot to bank on this thing called God. He can make it here. And so, he's done everything for me. Can be done. We're recovering now, huh? We're coming back. It's taken us a while, but we're coming back. And we've had help from all kinds of Elkies, all kinds of nice people. We moved into a predominantly Mormon community. One lady brings over, I don't think she knew what happened to us or how we got there, cinnamon rolls. Brings a plate of them over, that big. Light as a feather, beautiful. She brings over, what's that soup she makes? Some kind of chicken dumpling soup or something. Just every once in a while sends over a big pot of it out of nowhere. Jeez. So anyway. I'm the luckiest man in the world, and I know that. Not because of what I have, not because of what I might lose tomorrow, not because of what I might get tomorrow. And incidentally, I fight with that every day. The lotto. Does God want me to play it so I'll have enough to take care of things? Or does he want me not to play it because that's not trusting him? I've had a couple experiences. I'll tell you about one real quick. I decided I was going to trust him and not play it. And this was a year ago, maybe. My first wife got 3/4 of my retirement. She deserved it very much and probably more. So she had that for years. She passed away 2 years ago. God rest her soul. And she had a beneficiary. I didn't think they'd be allowed to have that. And her beneficiary was my son. So he got the 3/4 of the retirement. And so I told God, I'm not going to play the lotto. I'm going to go ahead and trust you. And my son called me and said, Dad, I don't want that. I didn't work for that. And my son sends me that every month. Right after I talked to the dog. And you, son of a gun, I know what you're doing. So that's happened a couple of times since we've been in Moccasin. And I've said, okay, I'm going to trust you. And then he shows me, go ahead. It pays. And then I think, shit. I could have played the lotto on one. One last thing. One time I was picking up a guy to take him to work. A lot of times roofers don't have their cars. I was picking him up, taking him over to the shop. And he said, well, pull over to the curb. And he went back and picked up his purse that was in the street. $450 in there. It was a lady's purse. I think she was a lady of the night. There was a roll of toilet tissue and a couple other things in there. So we went to work and we split the money. Damn, pay dirt. Well, I made a mistake of going to the meeting that night and telling some guy. Go ahead, did she have an ID card in there? Well, something with her address. You got to give that money back. I said, well, Dick already got half of it. You don't have to give Dick's back. You got to give your half back. I said, how am I going to do that? How do I? You get the address, you put it in the big envelope, make sure it's secure, and you send it to that address. Well, what if it doesn't get there? It's none of your business. You got to send the money back. Shit. So I sent the money back. That's all that you guys and gals continue to teach me. Every now and again, we're talking about this recently, every now and again I get too big for my britches, you know. I don't get that, not like I got this or I'm Mr. Big or anything like that. I hated coming here tonight and speaking. I wanted to pull a Billy Waller Billy Waller came to Ojai and spoke for me one night, and Billy was my sponsor back then. And Billy didn't like to speak, but he said, I'll do it for you. So he got up to speak, and first thing he said when he got up to speak there in the audience, I don't like to do this, but Ed asked me to, so I said yes. Kiss my butt, Ed. First thing he said, I got good friends. So, I just know this. I've been absolutely blessed to be a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't care what comes and what goes. I just want this. And if you're in this room tonight and you're having the same kind of trouble I had, these 12 steps, and they used to tell me that over and over, now I'll tell somebody else, they're not difficult, they're just to save you from drinking. That's the whole deal. Just take them with whatever you got left. I didn't know how to take them. Guy had to show me about a 4-step. I didn't have any resentments, so I got here. Humble, modest man who drank too much. Gave me that 4-step and he gave me that list. 18 pages of resentments when I was done writing. I thought, Jesus, how dare I think ill of anybody who does this or does that when I did all that crap. Alcoholics Anonymous is a lifesaver for alcoholics. No drunk should be without it. And I pray that everybody in this room stays sober for the next 24. Thanks, gang. All right.